Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
So your email, obviously it sparked this decision to have a conversation. It had certain resonances for me. I did a discussion years back in the Warty Theorems phase of the podcast with Ross about pornography.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can't even remember any of the details or anything. I just know it was a subject we went pretty deep into, and I know it's a subject that's extremely relevant and doesn't get talked about a lot.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, it's such a massive shadow in the culture that is so obvious if you look at, you know, the numbers on like a porn video that gets uploaded in like one day, like 100,000 people might be watching it in one day or something like that. Like if you look at those numbers and you compare them and you contrast them to like other examples of people liking things or how they can, you know, see how many views something has had, like on YouTube, for example.
Sure.
And it's mostly like probably, I mean, it's mostly men probably, but some women. But generally speaking, and probably a lot of teenage boys, but generally speaking, it's just fascinating to me that, you know, you never know. It's sort of like you never know who's got some kind of porno habit or something, because obviously many people do.
And they don't talk about it. Huh?
Yeah.
So why don't we, before we launch right in, do you want to recap whatever you're comfortable recapping from the email?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Well, basically, I guess in the email I was talking about how that conversation you were having with Alan Green brought about some thoughts in my head that were also, it related to what I'm currently drawing, because I draw comics among other things. And I have been sort of dealing with, or not dealing with, but in this comic that I'm working on, it's about it's this 3-page comic about just this fat kid that is probably like just 18, and he goes to a adult video store and goes to the basement of it to stuff a bunch of porno tapes in it, the old used VHS porno tapes into his sweatpants, and then gets caught by closed circuit camera, and the shopkeeper is actually like comes out down wearing this kind of medieval bondage outfit and like drags him through a hole, and then he's tortured to death by having his body and face eaten by rats. It's like this disturbing kind of a like tale of beware, you know, don't go down this path kind of thing or whatever. But anyway, how this all connected was, you know, a lot of it, this is sort of a exercise in relating an actual story that's closer to like when I was a kid. When I was 5, that was the first time I was exposed to like really extreme, like hardcore porn, because my friend and I were in the basement of his father's house, and his uncle, who was some mysterious uncle somewhere, had this massive collection of stacks of pornography in the basement, and I was looking through, you know, these magazines, and fairly slightly titillated by it, confused by the experience. But at one point, there was one of the stranger ones I was looking through had a horror movie review section, and my titillation was pretty sharply contrasted by the sight of the woman impaled on a stake from the movie Cannibal Holocaust. And it's something that, like, really is emblazoned in my brain. Like, I can always remember. It took me a really long time, you know, until I kind of got into horror movies and, you know, obscure cinema and things like that. It took me a while before I was able to actually make the connection that it was Cannibal Holocaust, you know, the actual movie. Mm-hmm. Basically, it just, the discussion you were having with Alan, it brought some of those things together for me, I guess, a little more consciously than they, you know. There was some synchronicity to it. I know Alan is this big synchronicity guy, so I was trying to avoid that word. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
So the strongest connection to me in this anecdote, more than an anecdote, but is the correlation between pornography and horror, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Which, have you read Seen or Not Seen?
No, I haven't read it.
Well, if you have had read it, and when you do read it, you will be struck by remarkable parallels there, which I imagine I'll get into.
Mm-hmm.
But before I go into that, what about the shaman? Because the email thing you sent me with the title was Shaman Porn, so where does the shaman aspect enter into it?
Well, when you were talking and with Alan, that was sort of the general
because of my accounts, right?
Totally.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I mean, so much of this for me, like, I have this, there's a descent into the underworld kind of thing going on with that sort of pornography, within the spectrum of pornography or whatever. There's this, there's this avenue to the underworld with it. Even in my own dreams, I have that sort of, that happens often. You know, I have dreams where I go to a video store, and then the basement is this place that you're not really supposed to go to, and that's where this crazy porn is. That's maybe the, you know, with the descent into the underworld in the shaman and pornography, I don't know if there's something to that, and especially, you know, liminality as, you know, this in between, you know, as a pornography, as a medium, you know, as to access that, even if it's, you know, not something that you intentionally wanted to use. Yeah.
Well, the obvious correlation or the unifying element is the id and the unconscious, so that unifies the basement with sexuality, with horror, with suppressed psychic material.
Mm-hmm.
How old are you? When were you growing up?
I'm 41, so that was 1979.
And were you familiar when you were growing up with the Video Nasty? Because that's what Cannibal Holocaust was. That was one of what was called Video Nasties in England when I was growing up.
Yeah, by the time I was like, by the time I was a teenager, I was, you know, getting into the sort of more underground stuff. And when I was a little kid, up through maybe like around 12 or so, 13, I was mortified by horror movies. Like, they scared the shit out of me, and I I mean, like, more than I was really embarrassed by it, how scared I was by them. And then by the time I was a teenager, I could handle it.
Right.
Right.
So, but were you familiar with, was there a equivalent phenomenon when you were growing up to the video
Oh,
nasties and these
right. Yeah.
really gross horror movies that you weren't allowed to see?
Well, it wasn't, the thing was, is like, it wasn't that all right, so I had a strange access to the stuff, to the, cause kind of videos as like a teenager, because the local video store that I used to go to was run by these Lebanese guys that got a lot of weird videos. And it just, so, like, I saw a lot of that more, like, Faces of Death and like, that kind of stuff, which I guess would be, but there wasn't, where I was, there wasn't really a lot of like people that were freaking out about, there wasn't a big satanic panic thing going on or like any of that kind of stuff. There wasn't like, there was a little bit, but there wasn't like people talking about the negative influence, or at least there wasn't in my family or anything. And I wasn't, I didn't have a lot of teachers talking about, the negative influence of horror movies or anything like that. I think in England, you guys had like a real campaign against them.
Yeah, there was a campaign. It wasn't exclusively Christian, but it overlapped with Christian. Mary Whitehouse, for example. And, so it's interesting. I mean, I wasn't actually zeroing in on the taboo factor when I was asking this. I was just curious about the about your cultural background and whether how close it was to mine in this regard. But you, it has made me think of that element that when something is taboo, it becomes more desirable. And like I've said on a previous podcast, I think that my first cigarette sexually aroused me, and I was puzzled by that at the time, and even later until I realized that it related to the taboo element there, that there was just something sexually exciting about breaking the taboo. Because of that, you know, if it, the id, the sexual energy, is suppressed. Along with everything else in the id, but the, you know, the primary kind of substance of that awakening unconscious energy is libidinal. So then anything that stirs up the unconscious or that seems to allow access to the suppressed part of ourselves is going to tap into the our suppressed sexuality. So it's like the two get bound together in some way through taboo, and it's very basic stuff, the Freudian stuff anyway, of totem and taboo, and how civilization is repression, how we can only have a civilization if we repress our sexual urges at a very early age, well, in adolescence, I mean, because I don't think it needs to be suppressed as children.
Right.
And then that's liminality. So yeah, it's a huge thing. This is why I wanted to talk to you since I read your email. So I thought, oh gosh, that there's just so much in that.
Right.
But bringing back to Video Nasty, then when I was adolescent, it coincided exactly with the Video Nasty craze in England. Which was, of course, created by the people who were trying to suppress them. If there hadn't been these groups trying to suppress these videos, and they wouldn't have ever been called video nasties, and I wouldn't have had the same drive to see them, right?
Yeah.
Of course, that's how that works. But it coincided, yeah, my adolescence coincided with the video recorder, and of course, then that coincided with these particular films. I Spit on Your Grave, Driller Killer, Last House on the Left,
Yeah.
and several others, but those were the main ones. And Cannibal Holocaust was also one of them, with quite a few zombie movies. And so I wrote about this in Blood Perks, but also more in a more deeply psychological way in Seen and Not Seen, that intersection between me discovering movies, me entering into adolescence, and thereby increasing sexual urges, and the video nasty. And so what happened with me in brief, because I go into it at length in Seen and Not Seen, was that I didn't, rather than get interested in ordinary pornography, It was a little bit of softcore, but no hardcore. I didn't see any hardcore pornography until I don't know, I was maybe 18 or something. Rather than porn, I got into these video nasties. And I discovered pretty early on that I found them really sexually arousing, specifically violence against women. And so then I would... It wasn't just about video nasties then. I mean, they were obviously the most graphic, but they weren't necessarily... I mean, what's become now is this subgenre of torture porn. It's now been kind of incorporated into the mainstream.
Right.
Back when I was a teenager, there was no inkling that anyone could possibly be aroused by this kind of stuff. So I just thought there was something really wrong with me, but not enough to not do it, right?
Yeah.
So then I... Without going into too much detail, I would look for movies that would have a particular kind of violence against women, and then I would pirate and copy all the scenes that I found most exciting to me, and that became my own sort of not homemade porn, but,
right.
but you know, gathered and assembled assembled porn.
On a side note, because I've met a few different people who were like not compiling violence against women, but we compile violence in film, as you know, like back in when I was younger. And you had this kind of cross section, and other people that would also compile, you know, things from porno movies. So you had this kind of cross section of both of those kind of tendencies.
Right. Yeah, of course. I mean, as soon as the pirating became necessary, and that would be in the early days of editing. What people do on the internet all the time now is make their own versions of movies. Well, that was as close as I got to really using that technology to assemble my own kind of private viewing experience. As I said, I didn't because of discovering this kind of form of self-stimulation, I didn't really explore ordinary porn. And I think the first time I got, not counting a few Playboy videos, which are really tame, you know, softcore, I don't think I first got a porn movie until, and it was by accident, when I was going hunting in Soho in London for a pirate copy of Stanley Kubrick's Clockwork Orange, because it was banned in England, and I was desperate to see it because it was supposed to be so violent, and I was so interested in violent movies. So my predilection for this kind of porn overlapped with my just general interest in violent movies, and Clint Eastwood specifically, but Sam Peckinpah, and then also Clockwork Orange because of what I'd heard about it. And anyway, so I got tricked. I got conned by a porno store owner who just saw me for a sucker and said, "Yeah, I've got a copy of Clockwork Orange. Here it is." He gave me the brown paper bag with the video in it, and I excitedly took it home, and it was just some porn movie. Right? I don't remember if I watched much of it or all of it. I can't remember that detail, but I remember it was the first time I got a porn movie, and it was by mistake. So anyway, I don't want to hog this whole thing with all of my anecdotes, but I just thought I'd put that as a sort of counter example.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there definitely seems to be kind of like a little the thing with like there. I do think that you connected violence and porn like in a very specific way, or violence in eroticism. Like, I'm assuming like. You probably, I mean, was it things like women getting their clothes ripped off and those kinds of that kind of thing, or was it like women being tied up and mutilated? I mean, what was is it? How?
It was a fairly wide spectrum. So it was, I mean, specifically rape scenes. So there were, for example, a couple of rape scenes in Once Upon a Time in America. I remember a whole bunch of mainstream movies that I discovered by chance, I guess, that, oh, that's got a rape scene in, so then I would rent it again, and in order to copy the rape scene out of it. So there's a bunch of mainstream stuff, and then there were specific movies that had that were violence against women. I'm Spit on Your Grave, obviously the most notorious, but then there was also, for me, it went all the way into torture porn, as in women who are actually are being just being murdered.
Right, right.
So there was a there's a notorious Dario Argento movie called Tenebrae, which has a very long sequence in which this woman is murdered, and it is sexualized, no doubt about it, but it's not overtly sexualized. She doesn't have her clothes ripped off or anything. So it's I mean, feminist writers and film writers have noted it for decades that a woman being stabbed is, you know, is a penetrative act, and so the filmmakers are playing on that consciously or not. And so, yeah, those scenes also were arousing to me, and they were part of the collection. It was a very, very dark collection. And it really, I mean, what I explore in Seen and Not Seen is just how much unconscious harm I was doing to my own libido through that, using those images. But also why, you know, what was behind that, you know, where this rage that I had against my mother specifically, of course, it wasn't safe to express it or even feel it or even experience it, really, while I was aware of being angry about her. But I certainly wouldn't have fantasized about killing her or anything like that, much less express it, you know, or act it out. So then it was being suppressed and then re-emerging in these fantasies that were provided by the culture, because I wouldn't have even fantasized about hurting women if I hadn't seen, and I never did actually, because I didn't have to, but as soon as I saw these movies or these scenes, and I responded to them at a non-verbal or an unconscious level, just in a visceral way. And so then I discovered this thing in me, which I had no idea what it was or why it was there. I just thought it was something wrong with me, but it's harmless because I'm not actually doing any of this. It's just fantasy, and so I indulged it for how many years.
You had a lot of guilt about it, just as a general emotion.
Yeah, guilt, shame. I mean, I mentioned on a recent podcast or in a blog post, I can't remember now, but that I didn't actually lose my virginity until I was 27, and I would say that was very directly connected to that those early years where I kind of hijacked my own libido in that way. So I just didn't feel able to function in any kind of intimate experience, any kind of intimate circumstances with a woman or a girl. And I would say this is true of pornography in general, actually. I just, an extreme case of it, but I think it's not that different from what we do to our own libido just by using ordinary porn, so-called ordinary porn.
I was listening to that podcast when you were talking about those experiences that you had, like in the brothel, for example, I think when I was thinking about that, as it was relevant to the idea that you were trying to take control of, like, through, so you met with, like, you were working with the shaman guy, right, down there, and he and so there was like this movie that you were doing like a sort of method acting for,
mm-hmm. It was a premise. He came up with a premise, mm-hmm. which was this guy is trying to find his happiness, can't get a hard on, thinks he can, if he can find the perfect hooker and get a hard on for her, then he'll find his happiness. So we were just going to film scenes of me failing to get an erection in brothels. That was the premise of it. Not that it wasn't going to be graphic. I mean, right, it was clear from the start. We're not going to actually film.
That would actually be kind of a funny form of pornography in a way.
Yeah.
I don't know that people. I mean, some people probably would actually find a way to get off on that, I imagine.
I imagine they would. Yeah. We never imagined it as a pornographic thing. So I was being somewhat glib when I described it that way, although it did end up kind of graphic, not that anyone saw it, but
sure.
But yeah, it was a shamanic exercise, like reenactment. Like I don't know. You could give that various different terms. All I know is that it was very effective, and it was actually very enjoyable because we travelled around together with the camera, and it was me facing a whole bunch of fears. I mean, just going into a Guatemalan brothel time and time again. They're bars. They're just bars, but they're bars full of these girls, and just doing that at all, just going into those strange environments and having to interact, and above all to keep it cheerful because it's so weird. You're going in there with a camera and a couple of gringos, and it's tense. And even the transvestite was the first scene we filmed, and so it's just the discomfort, the potential for the discomfort of dealing with all of that. All of one's unconscious fears or mine, for it to spread and then get worse. Because if I'm feeling uncomfortable, then the girls start feeling uncomfortable, and so it was a real, it was a constant challenge in terms of just learning to be comfortable in really uncomfortable circumstances, and then specifically around my sexuality.
The whites of their eyes. They got sharp teeth. Deep breath. And lots of diseases. People say you shouldn't stay down here too long. Sense of lighting up, lose your sense of smell. I tell you what I'm gonna do. Gonna make love to a water ran or two. And create a family. That we call the survivors. And wait, do you know why? Don't be late.
Do you know about that that guy? I can't remember his name, but he has like a, it's like a self-help cult out in California where people go and the first thing they do when they get into this big group setting is they take their clothes off, like one by one. And they'll get up and God, I'll try to find him. There's a link to it. I'll send you a link or whatever. But I was just thinking about that because he's an odd. I think if you haven't, you must either. If you don't know who this guy is, you should. But because there's other reasons why, among other reasons, is he's into UFOs and things like that too. But anyway, he has people get together in this big group when everybody comes, and each person has to stand up, take their clothes off, and like tell who they are, and one by one everybody does it, and some people who are there have gone there multiple times, and it seems like partner swapping is like highly encouraged, and some people men seem to go there hoping that they'll get to a piece of that kind of action and stuff. It's a weird scene, but I saw it on Netflix, a documentary on Netflix about it. It wasn't that obscure. That was the other thing. And I've seen him interviewed on on YouTube by that guy Alan Steinfeld, I think his name is. He has like a public access show in New York where he talks to various New Age people. But it's just anyway it that idea of having people having to take their clothes off or you know like that I mean even like I can't I really don't like being naked in front of people and that kind of I mean I can my wife I've learned to be able to do that but even as like a little kid by the time I was like 2 I was asking my mom to like turn around when I got out of the bathtub and stuff like that you know.
That's unusual.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I really liked being naked when I was a little kid, and then I became, you know, very, you know, really, really shy about it. And, you know, I know a lot of those things correlate with, you know, I was born premature, and I was in really distressed baby, and I was in an incubator for like a week or two or something. And I didn't have any real contact, you know, none of that like initial maternal bonding thing happening. And I didn't really understand. My mom used to mention it to me sometimes when I was younger because I was a very temperamental, not really at home, but in school I was a real troublemaker and really temperamental, had a really violent temper, and it was like a perfect storm with sort of my inability to connect to people. Almost felt like violence was one way to connect, you know?
Right.
And, you know, like, my dad was a very violent person, and his brothers were really violent. They used to get in fights with other guys a lot. And, you know, there was a lot of stories about my dad when he was younger and about fights or beatdowns that he and my uncles had given someone here or there or various other stories. And I wasn't like a big kid or anything. I was really small. I wasn't tiny, but I was I've always been just this wiry kind of guy. But I had this chip on my shoulder where I wasn't a bully, but if someone bullied, not me, but somebody else specifically, I would just happily unleash on them, like just punching, you know, and like attacking them and feel like just no, you know, fear at all about it. And, you know, as I got older, I started to realize that I can't be temperamental in front of people in public like I could when I was a young man, because now that I've got like white hair, a lot of white hair, and I've got like a beard and stuff, I look like a maniac if I was to lose my temper. But if you're like 19, 18 or something, people will cut you some slack.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like, I don't know, that's that violence thing is something that I'm, you know, I think I inherited a lot of that from my father, who was obviously much more violent, and his father, who was much more violent than him, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, beating people up. And it was like and even in my family now, it's like a legitimate or in that side of my dad's side of the family, you know, it's like a legitimate way of solving an issue. You know, they're just like, you know, well, I'm gonna kick the fucking shit out of them. You know, I mean, they don't do it as much as they don't think they do it at all anymore, but people still sort of fall back on that as like, you know, it on violence solving their problems somehow or another. And yeah, I don't know that. I just wonder, I mean, you didn't, I just think, I wonder, for me at least, you know, violence in you're talking about violence in pornography or violence in erotica being kind of this connected thing. For me, they're really like I feel like they're extracted from each other, like very, like they're almost, it's almost the opposite, you know, like, it's the, like, to me, it's the most pure, it's like this, I'm trying to like purify, I want like a purified female form that is like unbruised and unhurt and like protected and like, you know, that would, you know, that's very sweet and kind and everything in that. And like, but, and then there's another side of me that feels like very violent specifically towards men, not women, mm-hmm. You know?
Well, yeah, well, I don't think that those complexes are mutually exclusive, because I also fantasized about being a hero saving maidens from dragons, you know, that archetypal narrative, because the age of chivalry, so-called, historically is closer to the Crusaders, who were hacking limbs off,
right,
you know, enemies and raping women, probably, although, I mean, the Crusaders were supposed to be, well, the Templars at least were supposed to be celibate and so on, you know, but who knows, really. But certainly there's a clear historical correlation between the violence of war and violence against women as being part of the spoils of war. And then what you're describing there, that you don't see them as entangled, you see them as opposite, but of course opposites are also entangled. So when we worship women and put them on a pedestal, if we have a tendency to look at women as pristine and pure and perfect and to want them to be that, then we have the corresponding, the shadow of that is that we want to defile.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say that what you're describing is as different as you think, although we could talk about our backgrounds, because they clearly seem to be very different. So there wasn't violence in my household as far as I know, although I think my brother was abusive, but I don't have much memory of that. And but the kind of violence that you're talking about with your father, that would make for a very different imprint in terms of violence. That would, I imagine, be the cause of this deep-seated hatred of violence that you seem to have, despite having been a violent person. I mean, was your father a violent, as a father, like, was that part of his parenting?
Interesting. Well, my father, when he got together with my mother, it was the second marriage, and I was the last of. I was like the youngest of a bunch of kids that they had. My mom and my dad had from separate past marriages, and so my father was sort of trying. Like he wasn't violent around me, but most of his violent years had kind of passed, and because he was like 40 when he had me, or something like that. And most of his violent years had passed, and he had, I think, in my mom, seen a person to sort of be a better person for, kind of. And he had, in a way, like he my other brothers and sisters that were his other kids, they had a rougher upbringing than I did, mm-hmm. basically. Like they saw, like my brother, one of my brothers is 11 years older than me. He saw my father and my uncle stomp a guy almost to death and, you know, knock his eyeball out of his head. You know, I didn't see anything like that, but always knew the story. So those kinds, like, it wasn't like these were hidden stories or something. It was sort of, it wasn't even like it was bragged about. It was sort of just part of the narrative of, you know, watch out for dad, because one time dad did this, you know, dad did that. And he would lose his temper with people, and specifically me and my mom, and anybody that he was close to. But he was more, verbally abusive than he was violent. And, you know, I did have a couple times when he and I were kind of shoving each other around and things like that. But, he and my mother argued a lot, like, and you know, he didn't have a vocabulary that was, that expansive, and he tended to just fall back into the, like, you know, you stupid bitch, you know, you fucking cunt, like that kind of stuff. And my mom, who was really had a much more expanded vocabulary, sort of would use that to her advantage, and that would usually make him feel kind of worse about his inability to articulate himself, and then he would get even madder. It was like this weird kind of feedback loop people get into when they fight.
But he wasn't violent with her then?
No, he wasn't. But my brother's, well, my sister, one of my sisters claimed, what, from his first marriage, claims that he, you know, he had been violent towards his first wife, you know, which is probably, it's probably possible. I don't doubt it, but I don't, he wasn't, he, you know, he wasn't, yeah, there's, you know, there's more to all that stuff, you know, ultimately.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Well, that's because the threat of violence itself can, of course, be, have a profound impact on the child.
Yeah.
If there's an awareness of the possibility of it.
Well, I started becoming aware when I got together with my wife, or when I got together with her back in 2009, and when we got together, I was in a very this is one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, is because you talked about sort of this states of, like, when you, you know, had this notion that you were an archetype of Lucifer, or a, you know, something along those lines.
An avatar.
Yeah, avatar, yeah. Sorry. And there was a phase when, around 2009, when I was just having a very difficult time distinguishing between inside and outside of my head, basically. And I was just, I guess it was basically like, you know, panic attacks and nervous breakdowns, but I didn't look at them that way, because they sort of manifested in these, like, creative explosions, you know, where I would just do really out there stuff. When I got together with my who's my wife now, I was flipping out, like, regularly. I mean, most people in the more conventional settings would have just, most people would have just left me, but she dealt with me, like, waking up in the morning and, like, picking up a guitar and, like, smashing the shit out of it, you know, and going crazy, punching myself in the head, insane bouts of jealousy, like, massive bouts of jealousy over her past experiences with other people, you know. Right. I mean, it was like I couldn't even handle it. It was one of the most the worst attacks I'd ever had. I had this kind of demonic interpretation of my father that was possessing me, because when he had died, well, he died when I was 23, and I was sort of living with him in my brother's in the woods, and taking care of him, and he was going slowly crazier and crazier as he was dying, and the place where I grew up was falling apart, and it was getting more kind of almost like apocalyptic, like junk cars everywhere, and you know, lots of guns and things like that. And so I when my father died, I had gotten really depressed, and I, in order to sort of try to connect with him, would almost method act him out in a way. Like, if I noticed that I had, there were any tendencies that I had, like, you know, when I woke up in the morning, when my father woke up in the morning, he'd always sit holding his head, really, like, he was really frustrated. And I started noticing that, like, oh, I do that too in the morning. Wow, I should keep doing that, because that's how Dad did it, you know? And it was a lot, and I don't know that they were all negative traits, but that, but in a way, I was like trying to recapture my father, like in my own voice, like, you know, it, just looking in the mirror, trying to find him in my face, things like that. And I imagine that that sort of, I probably put something into my subconscious by doing that repeatedly so often, and then suppressed a lot of it, obviously. And it started manifesting when I found this partner who I thought was kind of too good for me, sort of. And then I just had this real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde thing happen, where I would be, you know, like, what's wrong with me? You know, 1 minute I'm totally fine, where I'm in love, you know, not just fine, but like manically in love. And then the other minute I'm violently angry and you know, just like Luciferian, I guess. Like, I want to torture, I want to punish, or I guess it's one interpretation of Lucifer, but at least in that idea of, I would actually say more satanic. If you're,
were you having fantasies then?
No, it wasn't fantasies. It's almost like they would come out in these like, well, actually, some of them were fantasies. I would have fantasies about, you know, fighting. You know, it was never violence towards my part, towards my girlfriend at the time. It wasn't, I mean, I would get mad at her. I'd be like, you know, you slut, things like that. You know, it was basically just almost like what my dad used to say to my mom, you know, like, I mean, that's easy. That's easy enough to understand. But
right. So was your father, as far as you know, well, you said with his first wife, maybe he was violent towards her. And then, so then that was a part of him or a side of him. It was, seems like it was a side that he either integrated or he disowned and suppressed it.
Yeah.
He made an effort not to be that way anyway.
He did. So. Yeah, he tried. It seems to me to be, like, at least looking back in my life, that he, given his trajectory, that he had somehow made an attempt to stop. And I believe that that was probably because he didn't drink anymore, but he actually did drink. I mean, he did drink still, but he didn't drink like he used to drink.
Right. And
I think that that was sort of his thing. Like, well, I don't drink anymore. He brooded a lot. And if he drank, you know, he would get into this sort of like happy clown kind of, you know, I love everybody sort of mentality. And, yeah.
So then why would he need to stop drinking in order to be less violent if drink made him clownish?
Well, I don't know that. I believe that drinking actually probably, I mean, it was clownish, but then after a certain point, I think that led to him being violent. The violence with him, it wasn't random. It wasn't like he went out just looking for fights. It was specifically that he got in, when he was a young man, it was one thing, he'd get in bar fights and things like that, but the reason why he and my uncle beat up this one guy was because he had abused my sister.
And sexually.
Well, I don't know that, but I can't imagine that wasn't the case. And one of the things with my father is that he was obsessed with the idea of people molesting children and whether, right. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. And he was really angry about it. Very, very angry about it.
So people that he knew or people in the world?
People that he would say, he oftentimes he would say, watch out for that guy. He's a tricycle seat sniffer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was like, I heard that often. And one of the things that was weird about him was that he would, you never knew if he was saying it about someone because he was trying to demonize them or not. You didn't know, like, he could be, like, for example, when my mother divorced my dad and married this other guy who was a really nice guy, and he was probably 15 years older than my mom, 13 years older or something. My dad was 8 years older than my mom. And my father was very upset by it, and she lived right down the road, and I was like 20, about 20 or so. And he used to talk, he would tell me, you know, be careful, don't let him around your nieces, because I have heard some stories about him that, you know, that he's into little girls and things like that. And so I know for a fact that this guy that my mom married was like, I knew the guy for another almost 18 years or something like that. And the guy from what I can tell, did not have any predilection towards, like, sexually towards children or something. So my father's thing with that stuff, with like maybe lying about somebody having an interest in that. And, you know, he also, yeah, he was real. So yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, is I'm not sure if that's what had happened to my sister. You know, right. I know that from the story was that my father always referred to was that she had been pushed down the stairs by the guy, and that he had on multiple occasions told the cops, you have to do something, because it was in the early 70s and things were different back then, I guess, you know, domestic violence and stuff like that. And this guy that my dad and my uncle beat up was a Vietnam vet Marine, and he was probably nuts, you know. I think that my dad's obsession with people molesting children, and, you know, anger towards them was kind of, it was hard to really discern what it was about, you know?
Yeah, well, I was going to get there, but first off, there's a couple of things there. Your sister is much older by the sound of it. So right? That's your half-sister?
Yes, my half-sister, yeah. She's my right. She's 5 years older than me. That's my,
right, okay. So bringing back to that, The big question, yeah, why your father was obsessed with pedophiles.
Yeah.
Have you thought about how homophobes, you know, what they say about homophobes?
Oh, yeah, totally. I have thought about that. Yeah, totally. And that's the other thing, is that there really wasn't any manifestations of that either. That's the thing, yeah, like, there was nothing, he never was inappropriate ever towards my two sisters, who lived with me, were my mom's daughters, or me.
How did you know that?
Oh, well, you're right. Yeah, there is those sort of like repressed memory type things, yeah.
Well, I mean, with you, of course, then you're more likely to know, and then there's even repressed memory, but then you were talking about other people, so then that seemed as even without repressed memory, there would still be.
Yeah. Well, I was
uncertainty.
To tell you honestly, the more that, like, and post analysis of my father, I would imagine more that something happened to him, because he didn't have this. I guess I'd have to find out. You know, he was interested in pornography himself. Like, he had these like Penthouse magazines and stuff. Like, I don't, that he would keep under his in his dresser and things like that. And he was like, he didn't have a, he almost, when I got to know him, when he got to be, when he was older and I was an adult, you know, he was kind of upfront about his sexuality to me. Like, he would talk, it's funny, he would talk about being in the Coast Guard and about how many gay guys were in the Coast Guard, and how, in things about, you know, how he had a lot of gay friends, and how he almost, you know, wished it, you know, hey, it would have been nice to be gay, because, like, they seem like, he said, I feel bad for gay guys because it seems like to be a really hard life, you know, to be that way. But, you know, I envy them in a way because, you know, they seem to have, you know, like a lot of class and style and things like that. Cause my father dropped out of school when he was 13, and he, you know, had a lot of low self-esteem about his intelligence and stuff. And he kind of looked up to people sometimes if they were in a position, you know, like, he was friends with a former college university professor and university president. And, you know, that made him feel good about himself, you know, things like that. But, like, as far as the, you know, in post-analysis of him as an adult, like, I don't see, like, any evidence, at least memorable evidence, that he had those predilections himself. it seems as if, you know, and he didn't ever describe anything happening to him, and I feel like he probably would have, because he was pretty open with me about stuff.
Well, first off, there was a homophobics, generally homophobics, they're not closet homosexuals, they're unpracticing, they suppress their own homosexuality, they wouldn't necessarily even be aware of it, never mind act on it.
Right.
So if we were going to extend that parallel to your father, then that's what it would mean. It wouldn't
okay.
mean that he was a practicing pedophile. It wouldn't even necessarily mean that he had conscious desires.
Right.
But it would suggest, I mean, I would say it's inescapable that if somebody has an obsession about pedophiles, it's because they're suppressing something in their own psyche, mm-hmm. unless they're actually surrounded by pedophiles,
right?
Well, which of course we are, but there's no reason to think he would have known that unless he was involved in stuff you didn't know.
That's pretty doubtful.
So that's the first thing. And the other thing that you're saying, that he would have talked about his abuse, I think that's, well, because I don't know the scope of your relationship with your father, but I would say even if you had the best relationship imaginable and the closest kind of friendship and the most open, I would still say there wouldn't be anything unusual about a person not sharing that. I'd say the opposite. It would still be unusual, mm-hmm. even in that kind of relationship, if in this case your father had talked about it. I mean, I was very close to my mother, and it's not till after she died that I began to see inconsistencies and begin to at least suspect that there was a whole side of her life that she kept hidden from us.
The suburbs of the outskirts of town. These are the places old friends push me down. Nothing but the dark stars shining on me. Loneliness seems to be my destiny. Listen to the old man. He speaks like thousands of seashells. Forever he's helpless. In those chaos of chords and bittersweet lyrics, singing eternally. Is there a place to hang around? Is there a chance for my woman to be found? I see no light shining down on me. I sing my song, lonesome and eternally. Listen to me. Like thousands of seashells. Forever he's helpless. In those chaos of chords and bittersweet lyrics, singing eternally. Like thousands of seashells. Wherever he's helpless. In those chaos of chords, bittersweet lyrics, singing eternally.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you it's funny you saying that, because I actually it's true. Like, I, as now that I'm an adult, especially now that I'm a father, that is kind of an illuminating thing that you pointed out to me, because you would not expect like your parents to share that sort of information with you once you're an adult. I do wonder about it. I mean, it's not something that for myself, like, you know, I just Yeah, I don't really know. It is. My father is a really confusing guy. So, you know, it's.
Well, the thing is that, I mean, there's context for this conversation, really, or at least how you began talking about your father, really, was in relation to Lucifer.
Oh, yeah, right.
The fragment. And so what we're talking about now is you, not your father, because he's gone. He's been gone for 18 years or whatever it is.
Yeah, since 98.
But whatever he wasn't able to deal with and integrate, you're now dealing with, and you're now having the opportunity to integrate, based on what you've described, and also based on the fact he gave you his name.
Yeah, and it's also his father's name. I'm the third.
Right, and yet you weren't his first son.
No, that was...
So he waited, for whatever reason, he waited for you.
Which is actually contentious with my older brother. He's always been pretty unhappy about that fact.
Really? Not getting the name?
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Right. So the power, the poisons are the power and all of that. You know, who knows? I mean, I wouldn't even try and speculate, but you might be able to speculate why it was you, why you got singled out. I mean, presumably the timing as much as anything, but when you were born, your father felt ready to pass on that, that legacy.
Right. Well, among other things, my father, when he married his first wife, she had had three children before. And two of them were boys. So he adopted two boys that were like, I think they were probably 4 and 5 when my brother was born. And so maybe, you know, that, so because they were already in the mix that over, and he had adopted them as well. So he considered them his kids because their father had died in Vietnam. And, you know, he took them on, but as his kids. And my brother was sort of like, he grew up kind of bullied by them. They were older and slightly older, and they were like a tag team kind of, Dale and Derek. And it's interesting too, because one of the things is my brother Dale is my half brother, but not technically. He was actually
adopted half brother.
Yeah. And, you know, he died in 1991, in a motorcycle accident. And it was the same year that my dad's mother died. My dad's mother died only a short time before that and stuff. And there was a period of time where I think a lot of I took on some of this old my old this older half brother half unblood brother. I took on a lot of after he died, and after my mom left my dad, a bunch of my dead brother's stuff ended up being at my house, and I used to kind of like hang out with it and go through it. Like I had a bulletproof vest that I got out of it, and his old jacket that he used to wear and stuff. And so I literally was wearing some of his clothes, and you know, some of his, he had old guns and things like that because they were into guns. And you've talked before about, you know, your brother, and which I think is really interesting. And he seemed to be committed to sort of expressing that kind of like devilish character. My brother, that brother that I had, I was 16 when he died, and he was 31. So he was 15 years older than me.
Did you have a relationship with him?
I had and he was a sort of a ghost in general in my life. You know, he kind of came and went, he was around, you know, that my dad was a roofer and my brothers were roofers and they worked for him. So they would be at my house sometimes and, you know, dropping off crap from a job or whatever. And, you know, and I would go to, you know, the amusement park with them sometimes, you know, with my other brothers and sisters and stuff like that. But he was so much older than me. He already had, by the time, you know, he was 31, he already had a kid and everything.
How old was he when your father adopted him?
He must have been like five or so, maybe four.
Ah.
Yeah.
And so you knew him. He was around from when you were born.
And he was like, and speaking of like homophobes or whatever, he used to, like he was in the Coast Guard, and I heard stories that he used to go, fag bashing, as they called it. And that brother, I don't know if that's true or not, but it is relevant to the conversation, as far as the topic that happens to be.
Yeah, definitely. Is this Dale then?
Yeah, that was my brother Dale. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and there's
And
a
why
whole.
did
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
you inherit his stuff, and why do you think you ended up, adopting it?
Well, when my mom left my dad when I was 19 and moved down the road, and my brother Derek, who was Dale's younger brother by like a year or something, I don't know if they were really close. In fact, Derek watched Dale die on his motorcycle because they were out riding together. And when my brother died, he became really mythologized by by that side of my family. Like it was like just they saved the motorcycle parts that were all burnt up and smashed, and they like saved his leather jacket, and it's just and they still do the same thing. I mean, it's like this big to do about him. They won't let go of it at all. And I saw the genesis of it, I guess, in them taking all of his stuff and putting it in at my house and just boxing it up. That the beginning of it for I mean they weren't honoring him, like saving everything that he possibly had acquired in life or anything like that. But for me, I basically was bored a lot because I was broke. I had hardly any money, and I was living with my father and my brothers, and who had moved in after my mom left. And they had all these girlfriends coming and going and stuff, and my dad had people staying at my house. And my dad had kind of a affinity for people that were a little transient, like people that had that needed a place to live for a little while and things like that. And so, and I played music, and I had a lot of friends that would who were young, that would like from high school, that would come and stay at my house a lot and stuff. It was a real active place. There was a lot
How long was your father doing that?
of doing the living in that situation at
Well, I mean, having strangers come through and stay over and that
Well, they weren't really
situation.
strangers. They were people that he knew pretty well.
Strangers to you, though,
Yeah,
yeah.
well, most of my life, like it would be, every once in a while someone would come and stay. Like, I had a few, yeah, there was people that came and went over the course of the years that would stay for, short periods of time. Yeah. But the I forgot where I was going.
Well, it was kind of an unfinished thing about Dale, but I mean, the impression I got initially, primarily, was that he was kind of the family, as a person that people looked up to and thought very highly of.
They did in a way, like they did on my dad's side of the family. Like he
Right.
on that those brothers and sisters. My two sisters on the other side, had a different relationship with them than the other brothers and sisters did. Like I've always been very in between these two. I'm the only one of between my parents, and then my so I've always been between these two groups of siblings. And I they get along with each other, but they're much different, like in how they continued on with their lives. Like my dad's side are working real working class, like people working poor to some extent, at least at this point, because no one makes any it can make a decent wage at all. And and my sister's side, they're a little more socially mobile, I guess.
So you better spell it out for me now, because it's a bit confusing.
Yeah.
Just describe exactly the sibling cast.
Okay. Well, my mother has two daughters that are 6 and 9 years older than me.
From her previous
Her first
marriage.
marriage, yeah.
All Right, and they're, so they're your half-sisters.
Yeah.
And that was, of course, later.
Mm-hmm. And I grew up with them as, like, a primary, like, sibling kind of, like, experience. Like, they were in the house with me and my mom and my dad, you know, until they went away to school and stuff like that. And my other brothers and sisters lived, like, 20 minutes down the road with their mother. Yeah.
The other brothers and sisters from...
From my father's marriage to his first wife. So that was his three adopted kids and his two natural kids.
Right.
Yeah.
And so your father and your mother only had one kid that was you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yep. Yep. I was the youngest, ultimately, so...
You ended up being the youngest, the last.
Yeah.
Which fits with the poison container thesis, right? The youngest, the last one is the one that gets the poisons.
So what is this poison container concept?
It's from Lloyd DeMaus, and it relates to how parents pass on the psychic distress of trauma and the poisons of their own trauma, sexual abuse, whatever has happened to them in their childhoods, how they pass it on to their children one way or another in order not to have to deal with it themselves and even have children in order to do that.
Oh, wow.
So generational wounding, really, how that gets passed on if it isn't healed, made conscious, integrated before dying, I guess. A parent can still work with it after having a child, but I think it gets a lot harder in many ways. But yeah, certainly once the parent dies, then where's that psychic stuff going to go? It has to pass on to the... Not necessarily the oldest child. I mean, in my case, I think a lot of it, my father's unresolved psychic distress did go to my brother. And he was more enmeshed with my father because he hated him.
Hmm.
I'm sure some of it... I imagine some of it went to me anyway. But certainly when my brother died, then that was it. The buck stopped with me. But I don't think it's just about age. I think it's also about who's resonating with it, who's most enmeshed with that parent, or who the parent identified with. I don't know. I'd have to speculate there, because I don't think this doesn't happen at a conscious level, obviously.
Right.
But your father naming you Jim... that's a conscious thing, but it's also there's an unconscious, something unconscious in him that caused him to do that. So that's a clue, right? It suggests that in some way you meant more to him than the others, and as you pointed out, you were the youngest. So
well, and it's also something that was that side of my family, my brothers and sisters, or at least my sister and my brother. That are my natural brother and sister on that side, have a tendency to point out, like they'll, or sort of act like my brother will act sort of, you know, with the, you know, dad, I should have gotten that name or whatever. There's never any outright, no one's ever going to outright say, oh, dad liked you better or anything like that. You know,
right.
But there's these negative suggestions, you know, sort of like that they missed out on a relationship with him while I had one more, you know, and I have a nephew who's 11 years younger than me. That is my older brother's son, my brother, Lance, is his son. And, he's the same distance in age from me as I am from my brother. And I kind of, you know, I look at him sort of like a little brother, you know, and I think that he is out of anybody, and he's very similar to me in a lot of ways. He's creative and, you know, he also was drawn to, you know, sort of satanic concepts and, you know, this kind of similar kind of occult leanings that I had had. I mean, I may have influenced it to some extent.
Yeah. So, if this is going to podcast, by the way, this would probably be the halfway mark. We've been on an hour and 15 minutes. So, there's certainly a lot to to explore here. I can see why who wanted to talk. What was I going to say? Yeah, right. There was a key thing that you said much earlier on. To me, it seemed key, and so it still does, after all this information, and that was that you felt that you had kind of self-programmed yourself to identify with your father or to embody something about your father. You remember?
Yeah.
Saying?
Yeah.
Right. So what struck me about that was that you were blaming yourself in a sense, or you could say taking credit, because you didn't necessarily frame it as a bad thing, but you were describing it in such a way as if you had consciously caused something to happen, and I don't think that would be the case. I don't think that's possibly the case. What you described seems to me that you turned it on its head, because what you described sounded more like there was something in you that was driving you, that was passed onto you or put into you by your father, that was then driving you into these behaviors, as opposed to you actually putting something in your unconscious. I would say that what you were doing there was trying to get something out.
Right, right.
By making it conscious.
Right. I get it now. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's... I don't know what to call it, the meta-narrative, or that's the crux, and that's the kernel, that's the core of what we've been talking around, I think. And
well, it definitely weaves into, like, the work that I've been doing artistically mm-hmm. all these years, which is
right.
something that has been, like, this demonology series that I started working on in 2006 that literally almost became like, I at different points was thought that I had made a huge mistake even attempting it, because I was feeling so out of control mentally. And, but one of the things that has at least come out of this in the process of working on the series was I started realizing that I was drawing these sort of caricatures of my father as expressed through these demonic spirits that are from that King Solomon's Goetia. And
isn't that Crowley? Didn't he?
Well, this is kind of the thing about the whole process of what I was doing with this demonology, is it is Crowley. It's specifically taken from interpretations and reinterpretations, because I'm thinking of the process of how information degrades as it's passed from one source to another, like the telephone game, you know, when one person says a phrase and by the time it gets to someone.
Chinese whispers, yeah.
Yeah. I was originally, when I started working on the series, just sort of looking for something interesting to draw and to commit myself to do a project around. And I was like, oh, the demons of the Goetia, you know, that's interesting. They're cool looking, you know. there's a market. There are people that will be interested in this and stuff. Because I'm an illustrator. It's like I was trying to think kind of almost capitalistically about how I can do something that would get me some money.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then as I started working on the project and stuff, I started getting deeper into it. And also, you know, I started making contacts with people that found what I was doing to be resonant with, you know, their interests or whatever. But, there was something about the misinterpretation and its relationship to, and like degraded information, and its relationship to like something like you know, at least in the mythology of these demons, is like they're these fallen angels or whatever, and it's sort of like the angel is like this pure word, and then as it's constantly being invoked over and over again in like someone's half-ass invocation circle that they made in their basement somewhere, it's just being degraded more and more and more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And as an example of that, like, there's this one demon named Valfor, who appears as, in the description in the Gwisha, as a lion with an ass's head. So in the, when I drew it, I decided to draw it as a lion with an ass, literally like a butt with an ass for a mouth, because that's an example of, I'm trying to intentionally re-describe the demons and work with the fact that the information is degraded to the point where something is being intentionally misinterpreted. And I started drawing some of, like, if one of them is supposed to appear as a crow, but I did it as a chicken. Mm-hmm. And I actually, when I first started working on it, was like, what if I really hope that this isn't, the shit's not real, you know? Like, I really hope this isn't actually real. It's not like I'm not really invoking them. I'm not doing these magical rituals. I don't need a banishing circle. I don't need all this stuff, because I'm just drawing something from a book that is, I got at Barnes and Noble, like, it, you know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. Yeah, basically, like, as I started getting through it, and, you know, I just, a bunch of shit just fell apart for me, essentially, you know, and I started out really strong working on this project, and then, like, halfway through it, like, it became completely impossible to do it, because of my situation had changed so profoundly from where mm-hmm. I started, within a year. You know, I had been in a relationship for 9 years, and then all of a sudden, I, like, kind of lost it, and, you know, blew that relationship, and, like, went kind of into an underworld for quite a few years.
Good. That's the end of the first part of my conversation with James Quigley. If you want to check out James's art, you go to the link in the show note. And for the second part of this 3-hour conversation with James, once again, you can download it this coming Wednesday, the 27th of January 2016. Thanks this week to donators, Dominic, Chris, Dan, Mark, and Anne. Next week's podcast will be a conversation with Jason Wilcox, and after that I hope to be recording a conversation with the esoteric comedian Stuart Davis. Thanks as ever for listening and for supporting this podcast. Please keep it coming with comments, emails, donations, etc. If you do wish to donate, you can do so at the website horticulture.com/liminalist, or at the blog horticulture.wordpress.com. This is Jason Horsley. Liminally, you have now listened. Oh, now what you see right through.